So let me call your to attention. My name is Peter Fever, and I'm the director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies and the Duke Program in American Grand Strategy, which is very, very pleased to host our distinguished visitor today to give the von der Heyden lecture. I've been trying to get Dr. Carter to Duke for a number of years. He's one of the leading defense intellectuals and has been one of the leading defense intellectuals in the country for decades, and has an impressive record of service to the country in positions of great responsibility, but also as an academic, writing the kinds of papers that all of us academics wish we could write that are read at high levels and change the direction of policy. He is currently the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And in that position, he is a key person in the debates over how the Defense Department will adjust to the new fiscal climate, and how, in the winding down of one set of wars, they can prepare for the national security threats, not just of tomorrow, but of years from now. And so his decisions that he and the president are making, I guess he's advising the president to make, I should say, those decisions will have tremendous consequence for American national security for decades to come. And we're fortunate that we have someone like Ash Carter to advise the president in this and advise the secretary in this time. He holds an incredible mix of degrees in physics and medieval history, which a number of people have pointed out is the perfect blend of feudal science to run the Pentagon. And he has, as I say, a record of great judgment. There's one blot on his record, which I feel obliged to point out. Several decades ago, he passed me in my dissertation defense, and the country has barely recovered since. But besides that one mistake, he has served with great distinction, and we're very lucky to have him here. So please join me in welcoming Ash Carter.
Peter, thank you. Thanks for the welcome. Thanks for your friendship. Thank you for what you do for all of us through your thinking and writing and teaching. And that goes for all of his colleagues here at this terrific institution. It's great. It's an honor to be here. I've wanted to come here for quite a while and engage in a conversation with all of you about our most pressing national security challenges and how we in the Department of Defense are trying to posture ourselves to meet them. Peter was, as he said, one of my very first doctoral students, and tonight he gets to ask the first question, so which I'm hoping isn't payback for the questions I asked him. But just remember, Peter, we were reluctant, and things like that can be rescinded. Be careful. To the students here in the audience who are at all stages of your education, particularly for those who are undergraduates and the graduate students as opposed to the professional students, I hope that a consequence of your studying with Peter and his colleagues here and these courses, that you'll decide that a career in public service in some form is the right thing for you. You know, we don't pay as well as some other jobs, and the buildings aren't as fancy and all that. But we do have one thing that no one else has, and that's mission. And it's a great feeling to get up in the morning and to do something and be part of something that's bigger than yourself. And in our department and in the U.S. national security establishment, at least something even bigger than the great country that you represent, because we're so essential still to the security of so much of the world. And for those from other countries who are joining their own national security establishment or the international security establishment, and there is such a thing, and that's a good thing. Thank you too, because it takes the whole world working together to create the climate in which people don't have to worry about what we're doing, in which they can take us for granted. And you know, sometimes we get frustrated by that. We say, why don't we get more credit? Why don't we get more attention? Why don't we get more money? Why don't we get more? Sometimes that annoys me. But if I sit back and think about it, you know, that's really the way it ought to be. People ought to be able to get up in the morning and go to work, raise their families, have their futures, think about their future, free from the fear for their security, for their basic security. And a lot of the world can't wake up that way. And we always want to be able to wake up that way. We'd like everybody to wake up that way. So, in a way, the right end state is to be taken for granted. And so that's my consolation when I'm feeling taken for granted, which we sometimes are. I spent a great day. It's great to be here in North Carolina. I was, of course, down at Fort Bragg, from which many of the military fellows, at least, here originate. I know Duke has a new relationship with Fort Bragg. I gather your basketball team was down there and took on the Special Forces, which is your defense against our defense. And I don't know how it went, but I appreciate it that you went down there. I was down today with our, in addition to our Joint Special Operations people and Army Special Operations people, the 18th Airborne Corps, the 82nd Airborne Division, down there. And you know, it's great for me to get out, not only to places like this, so I hear what people are thinking, people like Peter and his colleagues, it's a great day for me to get out of the Pentagon and be with our people. And it's helpful to me, especially because I'm always mindful of something that Bob Gates said to me when Secretary of Defense Gates first offered me the job I had before this one, which was Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, which, apart from, as my children say, having the longest and most obscure title of any job, is the buying and management job, kind of, among the Undersecretaries of Defense. And Gates said to me, Ash, he said, the troops are at war and the Pentagon isn't, especially your part. And I want you to change that. That was 2009. And so the most important thing that I thought I needed to do was not the Joint Strike Fighter and shipbuilding and all that kind of stuff, but support to our troops in then Iraq still, but Afghanistan as well. And so we worked hard on things like unmanned surveillance systems that have been so incredibly important in Afghanistan, including novel ones like balloons rather than airplanes, because a lot easier to run a balloon up on a tether for a long time and have it look around than it is to run an airplane around all the time. We found ourselves subject to improvised explosive devices, IEDs, and so we developed the MRAP vehicle and fielded them in record time. It was summer of 2009 when I signed the first procurement order for the MRAP all-terrain vehicle, which was the version we needed in Afghanistan because it had an independent suspension as well as being heavily armored. So 2009, and by, I guess December, we were producing, really record time, we were producing MATVs in two sites in the United States. They were produced, they were taken to Charleston where the radios and Blue Force Tracker and all that kind of stuff, where all the stuffing was put in, and then flown to Afghanistan where they have saved many, 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 many lives. And you could go on and on. I mean, it's things that may sound important to you but are really important, like ballistic underwear, which we developed and fielded, several different variants, men and women, and so forth, and that's a very important thing to have gotten right. So, you know, for me, every morning, it's still the first thing on my mind and will be as long as anybody's in Afghanistan, that we here in the United States, we in Washington, we in the Pentagon, are first and foremost supporting our troops until every single one of them is returned home safely. What I wanted to talk about tonight, I guess I thought I'd pick up on where Marty Dempsey, Chairman Dempsey, who was here, I think you hosted earlier this year, and discuss, as he did, some of the main tenets of the new strategy that was just emerging when he was here, but that the president subsequently announced. And to understand what we're trying to do with the new strategy and how we're trying to implement it in the Pentagon, you need to situate yourself, or we try to situate ourselves, in time and in the place we find ourselves in strategic history. And that is this. We in the Department of Defense at this particular moment in American history are at a moment of great strategic consequence and great strategic transition. Because we're at the confluence of two great currents or two great forces. The first, of course, is that after almost 12 years of unrelenting and uninterrupted war of a particular kind, counterinsurgency broadly defined, in two particular places, Iraq and Afghanistan, that era is coming to an end. The war in Iraq is over. And the war in Afghanistan, as I have said, certainly and for sure is not. But we have a strategy and a plan and a schedule that I think has a good probability of succeeding, and which will cause us to draw down our forces in Afghanistan, and then over the next couple of years, and then create an so-called enduring presence that will continue to assist, along with our coalition partners, the Afghan security forces in maintaining stability in Afghanistan and in meeting our principal requirements, which is to make sure that that country is not again ever a source of danger to the United States. So we're transitioning security responsibility to Afghan lead. You see that happening right now, just there a few weeks ago. All that thanks to the superb efforts of our men and women, and also coalition forces, and also the Afghan forces, all of whom are performing superbly, and I should say at great sacrifice, and for the Afghan forces, at increasing sacrifice. And blessedly, for our own forces, fewer and fewer casualties, and you'll see that again. I was remarking today to my friends that this is the first time for me in 4 years that there have been nobody returned to Dover over the Thanksgiving holidays. First time, 4 years, and it goes back longer. It's just four Thanksgivings for me. But while we've been doing this, while we've been fighting insurgency in these two particular places for these years, and also terrorism worldwide during that time, which will not stop, during all that time, the world hasn't stood still. Our friends and enemies haven't stood still. Technology's not stood still. And so the time has come for us in the U.S. and the Defense Department to look up out of the foxhole we've been in, look around, look ahead at the security challenges that will define our future, the future after the era of Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, we would need to make this strategic transition no matter what. But we're also subject to a second great current. And that is the need to keep the United States' fiscal house in order, as outlined in the Budget Control Act, which passed Congress last year, and which required our department to remove $487 billion from our plans over the 10 years, over 10 years. And that we've done. By the way, I should say that 487 is on top of 300, for those who have been around a while, that we, under Secretary Gates, cut earlier. And we've done that. We've tried to do it in the best way, which is strategically. Congress hasn't approved, unfortunately, all of the changes that we have recommended, and I hope they do eventually, but they've not. And we also have overhanging us the issue of overseas contingency operations, OCO, or supplemental funding, which we'll have to transition to some other system in the future. But at any rate, we have made that transition budgetarily to the and met the $487 billion cuts in a strategic way, and that that change in strategic era and change in our budgetary environment together, we have accommodated. And I'd like, I thought I'd describe to you some of the ways in which we did that. But first, I can't let an evening go by without railing about what could happen, and especially sequestration, if a follow-on to the Budget Control Act isn't passed soon by both houses of Congress that the President can sign. Secretary Panetta, I've been saying for months that sequestration is disastrous for national defense. I feel like a broken record, but it really is. It would be chaotic, wasteful, and damaging, not just to defense, but to every function of government in a gratuitous and arbitrary way. It's not just the amount of dollars, it's the idiotic way that we're required to take those cuts. And of course, it's idiotic because the intent of sequester was to use the threat of cuts implemented inflexibly and really mindlessly to force Congress to enact a compromise deficit reduction plan. That was its intent. It was never designed to be implemented. It was designed to be too horrible to ever be implemented. And so if it comes to pass, it will inevitably lead to the hollowing of our force and everything we've tried to accomplish, impact our investments, our contracts, lives of our service members, welfare of our service members, our other employees, their families, and not just us, but all the agencies of government. And it, by its nature, it makes it impossible to devise a plan that substantially mitigates its harmful effects. So that's sequester. And if it happens, we will, of course, implement or execute it. And we'll have to work with everybody involved in industry, the industry that supports us, to mitigate its effects. Its effects won't occur all of a sudden on January 3rd, but they will be profound and devastating to us. And it's a real shame. It's that to manage, we can manage our security and our budget situation, but it's very difficult in an environment of instability and uncertainty. It just makes it very hard for those who are supposed to run the enterprise to do it in a responsible way. But we're still 33 days away from this, and so I'm still hopeful that in Congress, both Republicans and Democrats will exercise the necessary leadership to make sure that sequestration isn't triggered and that they put national interest above everything else. Sequestration is averted responsibly, as by the way many in Congress wish, then, as I said, under the Budget Control Act, our base defense budget will not in fact go down, but it will not continue to rise in the manner that we had planned. And the difference between our expectation and that reality is the $487 billion over 10 years to which I referred. So that's the budget situation. And so these two forces, one profound one of strategic history and the other of fiscal necessity, came together. And in that environment, we needed to put together a defense strategy for the United States. And that's what we did. And I've been doing this for a while. It was an unprecedented process in the sense of the depth of the involvement of the president, which was, impressive in the amount of time and that he was willing to spend with the defense leadership, basically in a conversation about the trajectory of national defense and what to do as we came to this transition point. And the result of that was to get that head out of the foxhole and look forward and try to look forward quite a few years. In fact, we tried to 2020, and I know that Marty Dempsey talked about the joint force in 2020. What is that going to look like? That was sort of our objective. That's what we set out to build towards. And let me give you a few of the ingredients of it. One is that obviously the force has got to be leaner, but agile, ready, technologically advanced. In other words, we wanted to take a number of steps to make the most effective use of our force in the era after Iraq and Afghanistan. So what do I mean by that? I mean creating a new post-Iraq and Afghanistan concept of readiness for each of our services. Not an easy thing to do. What does it mean to be ready? Ready for what? We wanted to preserve a great strength we have built up over the last decade, which is the tremendous talent we have in the all-volunteer force. We both wanted to retain it, and we wanted to respect it. In other words, no sudden changes in benefits and that sort of thing as the war came to an end, to be respectful of the human side of our force. We wanted to shift the great, tremendous weight of intellectual effort that this department is capable of, that focused on COIN, that focused on IEDs and so forth, to the new problems of the future, make that intellectual transition. To make a more effective use of the reserve component, the reserve and guard, which also we have depended upon heavily over the last 10 years and is an asset, and we need to figure out how to employ it to best effect going forward. So there were a number of steps that we took that were kind of basic in order to make sure that we made most effective use of the force that we had. Now to the force that we want. First thing, President Obama, one of the things he was very insistent on the whole way is he said, just in a era of budget stringency, make sure that you protect and go out of your way to protect the newest things because they have the shallowest roots and they're the easiest thing to pull out bureaucratically. And I don't want you to do that. So he made sure that we didn't eat our seed corn in a budget reduction. And so that meant continuing to invest, and in fact, we are growing special operations forces, actually growing them. We are increasing our funding for cyber, even in this environment. Same for electronic warfare and electronic protection, very important field. New capabilities to counter weapons of mass destruction, space, all of these areas that are so important for the future, our science and technology base. And of course, new capabilities, novel capabilities that we haven't revealed yet. All of those things keep those investments going despite the cut. Very important principle. A third thing, ingredient of the strategy, is our continued focus on the Middle East, which will be remain an enduring commitment of the United States, but also, and very importantly, our so-called rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region, a region where so much of our future security and economic interests lie. And here our goal's pretty simple. We want to keep on keeping on with what that region has enjoyed now for 70 years, which is an environment of peace and stability in which the countries of the region, all of them, can continue to enjoy economic prosperity. And if you think about it, over this, the Asia-Pacific region was not an era that ever had any NATO. It never had any structure to heal the wounds of World War II. And yet, it has had peace and stability for 70 years, and I maintain, and I think it's clearly true, that a critical ingredient in that peace and stability, which has led to prosperity, has been the continued strong American military presence in that region. That has played a pivotal role. And in that environment created by our military presence, first Japan rose and prospered, then Korea, South Korea, rose and prospered, then Southeast Asia rose and prospered, and today you see, yes, China, and in a different way, India, rise and prosper. And that's fine, but that environment is not a birthright. It's something that results in important measure from the continued pivotal presence of the U.S. military in that region. And in one sentence, the rebalance says, we're going to keep doing that. That's our objective. It's not mostly a military strategy. It's a whole national strategy. We're obviously economically engaged there. It begins with our long-standing principles, principles of self-governance and freedom, free and open access to commerce, a just international order, rule of law, and open access to all domains, including the seas, peaceful resolution of disputes, I mean, all those things that matter so much, and they're not purely military. But we do have a big role in the Department of Defense, and it figures in a large way in our strategy. It affects force structure and force posture. That force structure is what we have, and posture is where we put it. And I'll say more about that in a moment, but it is broader than that. It goes to operational concepts, tactics, techniques, and procedures, operations plans, and perhaps above all, our partnerships in the region, which are incredibly strong, and many of them longstanding, and many of them a building now. So we have in Japan, and in the Republic of Korea, and in Thailand, and Australia, long-standing alliances that we're doing a lot to strengthen and invigorate, and new security partners like India, Philippines, ASEAN Collective, and China, where we're enhancing our military-to-military relationship with China. It's an important objective for us, and we recently invited China to join for the first time the big exercise that we run out of Honolulu. The RIMPAC exercise. So our rebalance is about many things. It's not just about defense. Within defense, it is importantly, and that's what I want to say, I want to detail a little bit about how we invest in force structure and posture. And before I even get started, the question people ask is, well, yeah, now, Ash, I hear you talk about rebalancing, but can you really do it with the budget cuts you just described? Can you really do it? And the answer to that is yes, and there are basically two reasons for that. The reasons that we can enhance our posture in the Asia-Pacific region. The first reason for that is that the end of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan frees up so much capacity, which can be redeployed to that region. That's the first reason. And the other reason is that within the still substantial resources that we have, we are giving real priority to the kinds of capabilities that are relevant for the Asia-Pacific theater. So for those two reasons, we can do it and are going to do it. And I say to people who one asked me that question, you know, we're going to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. Watch. You watch. So what should they be watching for? I'll give you a few of the indicators. Earlier this year, very simple one, Secretary announced that in a very significant historical shift, we were moving more of our Navy to the Pacific Ocean than to the Atlantic Ocean. So that in a few years, in fact, it'll be 60-40, and it'll probably go further. And that's historically very different. We're allocating our newest aircraft to the region, newest tactical aircraft. So for example, the F-22 squadron, now based at Kadena, will deploy our first overseas F-35 Joint Strike Fighter squadron to Japan, 2015. We also are expanding the Air Force, our rotational bomber presence at Anderson Air Force Base in Guam, developing with the Navy and Guam, the Navy and the Air Force, their facilities on Guam, Anderson up in the north, the Opera Harbor Naval Facility in the southwest, and then also at some point bringing some of the Marines from Okinawa to Guam. But for now, the main event is the Air Force and Navy moves, very important strategically. Marines, no change in Marine Corps presence west of the international dateline, despite the fact that the Marine Corps is going to be reducing in size at the end of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. No change to Marine Corps west of the international dateline. And in fact, they'll be seeing more of the Marines in the Pacific, and the Army too. Why? Because they're not in Afghanistan. The Army itself plans to align 70,000 troops to the Asia-Pacific region and part of its new general regional alignment, which heavily weights the Asia-Pacific region. So in terms of our posture and where we're putting things, we're putting the weight of our effort there and the newest things there. We also have key investments that are relevant to that region, new things that we have protected despite this budget environment. The Virginia-class submarine, which maintains the really unrivaled undersea dominance of the United States, and the new Virginia payload module on the Virginia, which will fundamentally allows us to fire cruise missiles from unwarned from waters anywhere in the world. Also speaking of the Navy, our P-8, which replaces the P-3s for maritime surveillance, a very good program, and we're proceeding with the P-8. A lot of new ISR sensors relevant to that region. We deployed the Global Hawk to Guam about 2 years ago or so. The Navy has a version of Global Hawk called BAMS, which will also be deployed in the Asia-Pacific region. Our K-46 tanker, the new tanker that I spent so much effort years back when I was undersecretary to get going, and which is working very well. Boeing's doing a very good job on the tanker. We have protected the funding for the tanker. That's a huge program. And a lot of new ISR platforms, some of which I can mention, some of which I can't. A lot of new infrastructure and training infrastructure in the Asia Pacific region, and one I'll mention in particular is the test ranges in the Northern Marianas Islands chain north of Guam, the islands we used World War II to leapfrog through, Saipan and so forth. Very good training areas there. In Korea, on the Korean Peninsula, our long-standing presence. We're doing a lot to modernize there. Camp Humphreys in the south, some of the relocation from the old camps up along the DMZ to Camp Humphreys, another big project, and upgrading our capabilities there to include some things that we're bringing over from Afghanistan, like MRAPs, to the U.S. Forces Korea. and then, so all of these investments are going forward. They're all relevant to the region, and we have protected them. And that includes a whole lot of science and technology programs for visionary things relevant to the Asia Pacific, and electronic warfare, anti-jamming capabilities, a lot of things like that relevant to the theater. So for all these reasons, we can and will find the military capacity and also the intellectual resources to support the rebalancing of the Asia Pacific theater. Secretary and I are very focused on this on a day-to-day basis. I mean, second only to current crises and the war. It's something where we're not just talking the talk, we're walking the walk. Finally, last tenet of our overall strategy that I wanted to mention is strengthening our alliances and partnerships around the world, not just in the Asia Pacific, but around the world. And why do I say this? Partners are a force multiplier for us. If we have strong security partners, they can do things that we don't then have to do. And they can share the burden of keeping peace and stability around the world. And so we're not only emphasizing our existing alliances and partnerships, but trying as hard as we can to build new ones. We're trying to be as innovative as we can. Just like I said earlier, we're trying to be innovative with the force we have and use it to best effect, even though it's not going to be as big as maybe as we want, or have as much money as we want. We're going to be more innovative in how we use it. Similarly, we're trying to be more innovative in how we partner with other countries. New concept of rotational presence, like we're going to have with the littoral combat ship, forward stationing, rather, the littoral combat ship in Singapore, some of the things we're doing in Rota, rotational presence, which really refers to the Marine Air Ground Task Force in Australia, that we're doing really rotational, novel, low footprint ways of having presence. Exercise programs that are meaningful, where joint exercises, we do multilateral exercises, trying to gather more and more countries together, bring in countries that have antagonisms between themselves jointly in a exercise program with us, building their capacity, trying to do all of these things to maintain alliances and build new security partnerships in new ways, in ways that we've learned over the last 10 years as we've fought beside our partners in Afghanistan. I can tell you, you can go to a command center in Afghanistan now, anywhere, at almost any level of classification, and you walk in, you run into an American, you run into a Brit, you run into people from the whole coalition, all working side by side. That is a precious gift from what has otherwise been a miserable experience, namely fighting a war. It's a precious gift, and we're trying to keep that. So that's our strategy and the implementation of our strategy. We hope to win the confidence of the country in the support of that strategy. It needs not be said that we feel that we've done our part with respect to deficit reduction in defense. And but I would say to our citizens, and I say to our Congress, and we say to the President, we're trying to make these investment decisions in the most careful way. We're trying to be the most responsible stewards we can of the money we have, defend the country for the dollars that the country can afford to give us. And to do that, we have not only to make important choices strategically, the ones I've tried to describe, but we also have to make better use of taxpayer dollars. That's really critical. That's something that I, when I was with Secretary Gates, launched an initiative called Better Buying Power, and which was really about using the taxpayers' dollars better. There are two reasons to do that. One is so that you can deliver the security the country needs without having constantly to get more money. But the second reason is that if we're going to continue to enjoy the public's trust to get the money we do need to defend the country, we have to show them that we're using it well, that we're not wasting it, that we're good stewards. And that's what better buying power is about. It's about establishing affordability requirements for our weapons systems, managing our activities and programs for what they should cost, and not just letting them run over and paying the bill, looking on performers of the work favorably who do a good job for us and rewarding them financially, removing obstacles to effective competition, removing some of our own bureaucratic obstacles to effective performance and efficiency by the industry that supports us, aggressively managing the $200 billion we spend every year on services. When you think about what we buy, you think about goods, right? You think about ships, tanks, planes. We spend $200 billion a year on services. And I can tell you we're not as good at it as we should be. So in all those ways, even as we act strategically, we have to act managerially as well, and that's a big focus for me and for Secretary Panetta. And we hope by being good strategists and sound managers, we can continue to defend the country and enjoy the trust of the people it's our responsibility to defend. So that's what we're trying to do. And I want to describe that to you this evening, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you, Peter.
I heard from your staff that we may have to cut this shorter than we had anticipated. We have time
for a couple questions.
My first one, and then please get in line if you want to ask a question. My question is, when you did the strategy, you had to make assumptions about the way the world was going. Do any of those assumptions now, 18 months or 12 to 18 months later, look stronger or weaker, particularly the unraveling of the situation in the Middle East, the heightened friction in Northeast, Southeast Asia? Do they call into question any of the assumptions on which the strategy rests?
To me, the events, particularly you're thinking about Arab Spring and so forth, to me, they kind of reinforced our thinking in the sense that we knew we needed to get out of the, as I said, the foxhole we were in and begin to face the issues that will define our future. And the kinds of things you're seeing in the Middle East now are the things that are going to define our future there. So in a sense, they've reinforced what we knew we needed to do anyway. And the second thing is that a theme of our thinking, Peter, about the future really was, and this is easy to say, but it's hard to live by, of true uncertainty and the ability to have a force that is flexible and multi-purpose. And that's not just rhetoric. It means that when you're making decisions about whether you're going to have this unit of force or that unit of force or this program or that program. If this one's only good for one thing, probably not gonna, we can't afford that. We have to buy things that are good for a variety of circumstances for the very reason you point out, which is that we can't make solid assumptions about where we're headed, and we can't afford to be behind the eight ball in any circumstance. And we have a very high bar that we're expected to perform to. So if anything, to me, the last year has kind of reinforced what we... There absolutely are, and I'll take Africa is obviously not a quiet place. There are Al-Qaeda cells springing up in several places that we have to deal with. There's a broader demand for security in the continent, which is an incredibly important continent. What we're trying to do is be innovative and meet those security needs in those places with a lighter footprint. And that just simply means being innovative, and we're actually capable of doing that in Africa. And it's not the right thing in Africa to send over divisions and, you know, aircraft carriers and so forth. That's not really what the, so you have to match the need. Another place I'll mention is Europe, because Europeans always say, well, how come, you know, I'm not in your strategy? And my answer to that is very simple, which is you're not a problem. Europe is a net source of security, not a sink for security effort. And so it's a sign of Europe's internal and external success that, you know, we're not fielding new capabilities for the defense of Europe. Thank goodness that isn't necessary. There are partners. We're fielding things jointly and working together to go elsewhere. Yeah.
We have only time for two more, I'm afraid. Okay.
Thank you. So you've spoken a great deal about the implications of the fiscal crisis, which is largely a result of politics. So in other ways, aside from the fiscal crisis, how do you, as part of a bureaucracy and institution, navigate the tension between political interests, when there is a tension, and military interests, and the interests of your own institution?
It's an excellent question. It's a constant challenge, and it's not a partisan thing, because fortunately, you know, I think for the most part, people understand that national security isn't a partisan thing. It touches us all, and it is remarkably free from partisan rancor, thank goodness. But our challenge comes more from the economic consequences of a lot of our decisions, which turn out to be highly local. So if you cancel a program, there's an impacted industrial facility somewhere. If you move a unit from here to there, there's a base with all of its people and all of its jobs and all of its buying and so forth, moving from one place to another. Those adjustments are hard to make. We have to be able to make them. That's why I objected to that. The Congress, why are they denying us $74 billion worth of that $487 billion? I say, I can't have that. I have to be able to act in the best interests of the national defense of the country, and I can't have, local economic interests influence what we're doing. And, you know, it's a democracy and so forth, so you have to deal with that. But in the end, your best defense is a good strategy and explanation so that we can go to the public and say, listen, damn it, I know you don't like that. I don't like it either. But it has to happen because that's the only way we can defend the country. If we start deciding how we configure our defense by pork, we're doomed.
I was curious as to your thoughts on foreign military sales, in particular in situations like Turkey, where they're asking for, or they need Patriot systems and air and missile defense systems to guard against Syria, and how those kind of situations should be handled.
Well, foreign military sales is a good thing for us. It it has to be done subject to appropriate controls on who's getting what and all that. But in general, assuming these are security partners that we value, this is again a twofer. It strengthens their capabilities. If it's an ally, Australia or something, it strengthens their capabilities so that they can contribute to security in their for their country in a way that we do not have to make up. And it's good for us economically, quite honestly. I was the principal weapons buyer for the Department of Defense, and if I have, if I'm building F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, it's a good thing for me if Canada's buying some also, because obviously economies of scale, it makes my airplanes cheaper. For both those reasons, but principally for the security reason, provided they're, foreign military service is a good thing, provided they're aligned with your overall security strategy, which we have to do. We're not allowed to just go sell anything, and our contractors aren't either. We have to have licenses to export things, you know, and the approval of the government and the Congress, by the way, that selling that is truly in the national security interest of the United States and aligned with our foreign policy. That's the only condition under which we do. But if we do it under those conditions, it's a good thing. Thank you.
So you start off the speech by talking about concerns about whether you appreciate it. I want to assure you that here at Duke, we appreciate the work that you are doing.
Thank you.
We don't have ballistic underwear to give you as a token of our appreciation, but we do have an AGS t-shirt, which
terrific.
Is almost as good.
Very good.
And we trust that you will wear it with pride, and we're grateful for your service.
It's so valuable that I'm sure I'm not allowed to keep it.
Yes, probably.
But I appreciate it. I appreciate you being here tonight, especially you, Peter.